Hello and welcome to episode 15 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grundislav.
Knock knock.
Who's there?
Ben.
Ben who?
Ben Chandler, also known as Ben304. Hello.
Hi, come in. Come in. You're just in time to do this podcast. Good. Here, have a seat. There you go. Can I get you some tea?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. I don't actually have...
Delicious.
I don't have any tea, actually.
I brought my own with me.
Oh, well, actually, what I just gave you was cat urine.
That's fine.
Okay, cool. How are you, Chandler?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm well as well. What would you like to talk about on today's podcast?
I would like to talk about computer games. How have you been anyway? I haven't really talked to you much this week.
I've been all right. You know, same old, just kind of working. And this is my last week of working.
I know. At your current job, wow.
At my current job, again. It's the second time I've quit this job in 4 months or so.
But obviously you're still working on your game, which is your real job.
Oh, well. Obviously. Yes, of course, of course. Yes, I am. I've gotten quite a bit of work on it done just this evening while I've been talking to you. So, there you go. Cool. Yeah. Cool. How about you? What have you been? Man,
I've been working on both of my real jobs, making games and, you know, wrangling sheep. You played Primordia this week?
I did play Primordia this week. Yes, mm-hmm. I finally trudged through some of my backlog and I got to Primordia, which I've been meaning to play forever. And I really enjoyed it.
Good.
But I can cite Primordia later as an example and well, good. Not that much later, because, you know, we got to talk about it. But
we got a podcast to do. Did you play anything else this week?
Did I play anything else this week? I played a lot of Go to Sleep for a long time.
Okay.
That's my favorite game.
Instead of playing ZZT, basically, you're playing ZZZ.
Exactly.
Good. Wow. I haven't played much this week, because I've been working, but... Man, ZZT's great. Don't knock ZZT.
You just made a heck of a reference.
Yeah, ZZT is great.
Well, what are you talking about? You just finished playing, not like 10 minutes ago, EcoQuest, The Search for Cetus.
I know. I sat down, I got it off my shelf, never played it before, and I spent my whole Saturday morning playing it, and a little bit of the afternoon. It was pretty good. It was pretty fun. Last night I was playing some Nicopol, Secrets of the Immortal, and... That's interesting. I like it a lot more than I was expecting to like it. I expected it to suck. And it sort of does. But it also doesn't in some spots. It's got some really interesting puzzles. I'm stuck on a puzzle at the moment. I'm not stuck on it. But it's a sort of puzzle that I've solved a couple of times before in the game. I'm like, oh man, not another one. These take me forever. So I thought I'll give it a break and play some EcoQuest and enjoyed that.
Good.
But yes, so both games are pretty good. But anyway, we were talking about Primordia before.
Oh, yeah.
Before I rudely interjected with my games that I've been playing.
Well, I asked you about them, so there was no interjection there.
Good.
Yes, but...
How many endings did you get from Primordia? Because there's more than one.
Yeah, I got them all, actually. I went back and I actually played through twice. I played through... You know, the normal way, and then I went back and I played through with the commentary on, as I always often do with these games, and I got all the endings.
And how do you feel about the presence of multiple endings in the game? Do you think it was worth it?
In Primordia, or do you mean in general?
In Primordia. Let's start on Primordia.
Okay. Oh, we have two topics of discussion today.
Well,
actually, no, they kind of relate to each other. No, you're right. They really do relate to each other. You're right. Well, I got the good ending. Well, actually, one of the good endings first.
Okay.
And that felt satisfying. And then when I went back and I got the other endings, I have to confess that I thought if I had gotten some of these other endings first, I would have felt kind of let down or just kind of shortchanged, you know, because some of the endings, the good endings are really fulfilling and they're, you know, they make you feel good. And the bad endings are just kind of one or two sentences and then the game ends.
Okay.
So they're not as fleshed out as the good endings, which is a bit disappointing. But I mean, if you're going for the good ending, you get rewarded. Otherwise, sure. The bad endings are just a bit abrupt. That would be my only criticism about them.
Okay. Really. Do you feel that the game was improved by the presence of multiple endings?
You know, multiple endings, not just for Primordia, but just in general, I don't know how I... See, it really depends on the game, because the thing about Primordia is that it has a very... It's a game that has a very clear goal at the beginning, and then it kind of branches off into another goal. And once it gets into that second goal, that's kind of where it presents the option of the multiple endings. Because if it just stuck to the whole, we need to get our power core back thing from the very beginning, multiple endings wouldn't have made much sense.
No, absolutely not.
Having multiple endings for the second goal makes more sense. But at the same time, I don't know. I mean... Multiple endings are tricky because it's hard to describe. Maybe I should have thought about this a little bit more before we started talking about it, although it was kind of a spontaneous topic. But okay, yeah. I'll say this. Multiple endings can work and they can't work. I thought that they worked okay in Primordia. Okay. Other games where you have more of a black and white ending, like there's just the good ending or just the bad ending, that's a little bit more limited. But at the same time, I also feel like games that have a really lot of endings, like, you know, seven or more endings, that can be a bit overwhelming. Because as a player, you're curious, you want to see what all the endings are. And if there's drastic steps that you have to take to alter the ending, then it can be kind of a chore to see them all.
Just slow through the game. Yeah.
Right. Or if you have other things, like, for example, Deus Ex Human Revolution, which we've talked about several times, where literally it's pick this button and you'll get this ending.
Yeah.
That can feel a bit cheap.
All three of the Deus Ex games sort of have that last area where you decide the ending right then and there.
Yeah, well, Primordia really had that too, because even though it had about five or six endings... You really, basically, in the last room, choose which ending you're going to get, with the exception of one object that you have to get at the beginning of the game, which gives you the best ending, or at least one of the better endings. So, yeah.
Okay, well, that's it.
How do you feel about
the reason I brought it up? Well, the reason I brought it up is I've been thinking about, you know, when I'm at work, I often sort of think through plots in my game head, and there's a plot that I've been writing in my head for a long, long time, like months and months and months, that I haven't really talked to anyone about, and I got to the point where I was stuck with this dilemma of having an interaction, a very small, almost, you know, meaningless interaction with a character in the middle of the game. And I had to decide whether I wanted to make it so that was something that changed the end of the game or not. And it was a real dilemma, you know. I was trying to think, is my game improved by having this or is it not? And so I thought today we could talk about consequence in games. And yes. I have to say, I've pretty much decided to not give this particular game multiple endings. based on the fact that it's really hard for me as a player to accept the fact that something meaningless I did or didn't seem significant at the end of in the middle of the game should affect whether I get a good ending or bad ending. But then you get some games, like, I believe, you know, if you look at games like Fallout and Arcanum, and you've played some of the Fallout games, and even I believe Conquest of the Longbow has it where stuff that you do in the middle of the game really affects your ending.
Yeah.
So, I like the idea of consequence in games, and it's a topic very dear to my heart, but I don't know that, for me, that such a subtle thing as, you know, this was going to be a dialogue option should change the ending of your game. You've done multiple endings in games. If we look at stuff like Backdoor Man and Ben Jordan 8, what do you think?
Well, Yeah, actually, it's those two games are an interesting contrast that you bring up, because when I was originally designing Ben Jordan 8, I knew that I wanted to have multiple endings, because like I said in a previous podcast, when you do an episodic series, it's really difficult to do multiple endings in the different episodes, even though you might want to, because then it carries over to the next, unless you have a way like The Walking Dead where your decisions carry
storing
on to the
data,
next
yeah.
episode. Yeah.
I think Bone Runner does that a little.
Oh, okay.
But you did have a multiple path thing in Ben Jordan 3, although I guess the ending was still the same, but there was still the element of consequence there.
Yeah, there was the element of consequence, but really there was the good ending, which was like the really good ending, which was the canon ending, and then there was the not so good ending, or the bad ending really, which, you know, is not canonical with Case 4, because the rest of the games assume that you didn't, you know, it's kind of just like an alternate what if situation. But
sure.
I knew that I was going to finally be able to get the chance to do multiple endings with Case 8 since it was the final one, so I wanted to kind of be as different as I could. But I ended up doing 4 endings, and originally I wanted to do a lot more. I wanted to be even more ambitious. I wanted to even...
Really?
Yeah, I was actually considering having an ending that was affected by something completely meaningless that you did at the very beginning of the game, like in the first room. Like if you looked at something or you did some sort of interaction, it would give you a completely different ending or something like that. I really wanted to play around with that, but the more I thought about it, the more I disliked the idea.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Ben Jordan, I mean, there's a good ending, there's a really bad ending, and there's two kind of in-betweens.
Yeah, they're two...
Which...
Well, I think that in-between still have a... Well, at least one has still a fair bit of bad ending into it.
Yeah, there's a really good, there's a really bad, there's a sort of bad, and there's a sort of good.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You could say.
Yeah.
But essentially, yeah, essentially it's the same thing that happens at the end. I mean, it's not, you know, you get the sort of what happened to everybody at the end, and that kind of varies too, you know, between stuff, but... It goes a little bit drastically different. Now, Backdoor Man is just one ending, but
yes.
It depends on the outcome of what your of the three vignettes that you play affects the ending. I think when you have multiple endings, I think I like it better where the core of the ending is the same, but you kind of have little minor variations. Like you mentioned, Fallout New Vegas, you essentially
yes.
get the same ending.
Well,
but,
all the Fallout games, to be honest, and Arcanum.
Yeah, true. I like an ending where it's, you know, the main story resolution ends the same way, but sort of little minor side stuff is different. Like, you know, you get to hear what happened to everybody, all the factions and stuff in New Vegas. Or, you know, because, I mean, if it's like, you know, the game ends and... You did this, so you become president of the world at the end. But oh no, you did this, so your head explodes and you fall into a ditch. You know, that's a bit extreme. But if it's just, you know, basically like, okay, this is the end of the story, this is the resolution, but because you helped the homeless person at the beginning, they went on to do this, and, you know, kind of seeing how things happen. I know you don't watch films, but did you ever see... Well, I'm guessing you probably never saw a German movie called Run, Lola, Run?
I did not. I've heard of it, though, which is surprising.
Well, no, that's good. They made us... I had to watch that movie in photography class, actually, because there's a big... There's kind of a photography element into it. But it's an interesting movie because it shows you... There's a basic story happening, and it shows you basically three what-if situations. And the what-if situations happen, like, you know, the story happens, and then it shows you the story again with, like, 1 second before, what would have happened if she had started running 1 second before, and it completely changes the outcome.
Oh, wow, that's lovely.
And then what happens 1 second after, and that completely changes the outcome, too. But then I don't remember the ending. I don't remember if it all converges and it has just one ending. But also, in the meantime, as she runs past people and, like, she'll run and bump into somebody, it kind of does this little sort of side thing where it shows in really fast Polaroid pictures what happened to that person. So, like, in one version of the story, because she ran into them, they dropped their groceries or something, and then they, you know, something bad happened or something. And in the one before, she avoids them, so they went on to do something else that they were going to do, you know?
So it's kind of an exploration of the sort of butterfly effect, multiple universe, sort of the chain reaction of possibility sort of theories.
Exactly.
Guess, which is nice. And I have to admit, I really like that in games too, you know? I've played quite a few RPGs, and RPGs explore this quite a lot, where you get to the end of the game and, you know, whether it's the end of Baldur's Gate 2, Throne of Baal, or the end of Planescape Torment, where you've got these companions with you, and it does a little summary of that character, you know. Planescape Torment, not so much, but it's still the people that you take with you to the very end still have their little conversation with you, you know, and I think I agree that I like to get the same ending no matter what, but I like my playthrough to be adjusted, you know, like, I think stories aren't all about, you know, the ending being different. Stories are about individual characters. There's different, you know, little bits of a story where this is an interesting character, here's what happened to them. That's something I tried to kind of do when I wrote Piss, you know. Mm-hmm. Piss only has one ending, but depending on what you do, I wanted to make it, there's one point where you leave Limbo to go back to the real world. There's one point there where you have to choose a memory to get rid of. And the memory that you get rid of there affects what information you get at the end of the game. So if you get rid of the most obvious one, which most people, everyone I've talked to got rid of this memory, then you kind of miss a little bit of the story, a little bit of the backstory. So that, you know, I'm sure some people probably inferred it from the ending, but yeah, I wanted to make that a significant thing where Moira, you know, she doesn't remember very much at all, so her memories are very precious to her, and so she has to sacrifice one of these memories. And so for me, that was a pretty pivotal part in the story where, you know, which memory, and it surprises me that everybody chose the same memory. I guess it really doesn't, because, yeah, but it does, it was a way of me having multiple endings in the game without really, you know, of having consequence in the game without having to resort to multiple endings, because I always worry about multiple endings. My thing about multiple endings is this: it's really hard to write one good ending, like a well-written ending, let alone two or three or four. So I always worry, I'm like, man, I'm having enough trouble writing one ending. Imagine if I was trying to write three. That's something that I always worry about. Endings are hard to write, you know, to get one that you're really satisfied with. And I know Dave Gilbert, I've talked to him about the Shiver, I think it was even in the commentary, he doesn't really like the good ending of the game. He thinks it's a little too sugar-coated. So, you know, if you've got multiple endings, there's always going to be one that you prefer. I know with Fragment, Sebastian wrote the endings of that, but basically stuck to the basic plot that I'd came up with. And there's one ending that I consider canon. I think that'll be always the way.
Yeah. I think multiple endings like that work best in games where the character, like RPG games where your character is essentially a blank slate that you can project yourself onto.
That's a good point.
If there's a game with multiple endings where you have a protagonist that you're playing, but that has character and stuff, sometimes it kind of ruins the story you're trying to tell. Like Red Dead Redemption, for example.
Yes.
And if you haven't played Red Dead Redemption, I'm going to spoil
it.
I play it and then come
back,
God, because I'm totally going to spoil the ending.
If now, you don't have a console, Xbox 360 or PS3, they should be cheap now. Get it and play it. It's Rockstar's best game. I'm just saying
absolutely
that right
is.
Now.
But by sometimes, far. Yeah. Sometimes when you're trying to tell a story through a game and the story's not and doesn't have a happy ending, sometimes you think as a player, oh, well, maybe there's something I could have done to maybe, you know, make it better or whatever. But I think that in Red Dead Redemption, if there was an option that how you played affected the ending and John Marston, I can't even say his name, John Marston had survived, I think that would have really made the story a lot less powerful, because
yeah,
he has to die. I mean, he has to die.
That's he dies in a final stand, and you can't... Yeah. There's no other way the story could have ended than with that final stand.
Yeah, and there's no other satisfactory way that the story really could have ended aside from that. And as a player, you know, you're affected by that. And if you think, oh man, maybe there was something I could have done, maybe, you know, I could have done something and saved him or whatever, you're so emotionally invested in that character at that point that you think that, but to be able to actually do it, I think would have taken a lot away from it. And Red Dead Redemption really only has one ending, but it's still a great game and it's still a great story, and it doesn't need multiple endings because it tells its story. And, you know, it's a good story.
I think if Red Dead Redemption had ended where John Marston dies and doesn't have the little extra bit afterwards, then... And this is spoiling the game totally, but whatever.
well, we already did.
Yeah. If it had ended there, it would have been like, oh, man, I wish there was something I could have done. But they actually implemented a way for you to avenge John Marston. Yeah. And that's not obvious at all. It's very subtle. And I think they should be congratulated for that because, you know, John Marston has to die, but you still get to avenge him.
Right.
So, yeah.
And then, yeah, well, that's a whole other topic.
That's a whole other topic. but yeah, so you've mentioned RPG games like blank slate type characters. I think that works, but you also have to be careful to get yourself, you know, invested a little bit in the game, like Planescape Torment. You should play it, really. I was talking to you about the other day because it does, you know, so many things so right.
You know, I'm interested in playing it, but I have such a backlog of games.
I know.
I'll get to it eventually.
But yeah, there's so much consequence in that game, and one interesting thing about it is you really do play a blank slate character. You wake up with amnesia and remember nothing about anything and sort of decide who you are through the game. But another RPG I played last year, I think it was last year, and I absolutely loved, was Cult Heretic Kingdoms. If nothing else, Tom Baker does the narration in it, so there's something. and I didn't. I was playing the game going, I recognize this voice. I'm pretty suspicious here, and I googled it, and I was like, hey, it is Tom Baker, that's amazing. Anyway, so Cult Heretic Kingdoms, it's really got this idea of consequence in it. You can play whichever way you like, you know. But when you get to the end, I was really disappointed by the ending, because it basically shows a list of outcomes and highlights which one you did. It literally goes like, it's you know, savior, warrior, tyrant, thing like that, and highlights the ending you got. And I was like, oh my god, I would really prefer to have a single ending than this cop-out of an ending, which is a shame because it was a great RPG and I really loved playing it. Yeah. I really did.
Well, actually, I mentioned it earlier, The Walking Dead. There's a classic example of consequence.
Sure.
Now, here's the thing about consequence in games, especially when you have such drastic consequences like in a game like The Walking Dead. I find that it's tricky to pull off well because as a player, you're playing a game, essentially, and playing a game boils down to you want to succeed, you want to win. So when you have a game where the game continues, even though you might make a choice and it might not be the best outcome, part of you thinks also, again, oh man, I could have done that so much better, and the temptation is there to go back and try again, even though the game goes on. So in a way, it's kind of self-defeating because unless you're perfectly willing to accept your choices and see what the outcome is and accept that you might get a bad ending, a lot of people are probably going to want to go back and try for the good outcome. But that's the good thing about The Walking Dead, because no matter what happens, you're going to get a crappy outcome anyway. A lot of people complain, too, that The Walking Dead, because they made such a big thing about when it was going to come out about how the game was going to change based on your decisions. And I think a lot of people thought that meant that by the time you got to episode 5, two people were going to have a completely different game. But really what they said was the story is tailored to your decisions. And it's true. I mean, there's certain characters who live and die based on your decisions, but ultimately the story goes down the same path, and while it might have some minor variations, it ultimately ends the same way. So it's really interesting what they did with the choices and the consequences, but it's more like what I said I enjoyed, that in that, you know, you have the main core game, the core plot stays the same, but you just have little variations of how you get there.
Sure. I it's a pretty ridiculous expectation that a studio as small and sort of budget constrained as Telltale were going to make a totally different game.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think anybody has ever pulled that off. It's just such a sheer undertaking that I don't know if it's even possible by even if you had all the money in the world. I mean, I'm sure with all the time and money in the world, you could probably end up doing that, but
probably.
It just seems so impractical.
Let's talk about Heavy Rain.
Oh, yes. Let's talk about Heavy Rain.
Heavy Rain, one thing that David Cage really embraced in this game, other than all of his normal David Cage things, was the idea that no matter what you do, the show must go on. Now, no matter what you think of Heavy Rain as a game, I think you have to admire this sort of... It's a departure from the games that we're used to. You know, games... Everybody's seen game over screens. Games end, you know? If you do something wrong, there's a game over thing. And even sort of in a LucasArts adventure, if you don't do the right thing, then you're stuck, you know? You just can't progress. Whereas in Heavy Rain, there's no really getting stuck. There's no really doing the wrong thing. If your character dies, the story goes on without them, you know? And... Yeah. Do you admire that? I think I admire that. I don't think Heavy Rain is a perfect example of game design. I think there's quite a lot wrong with Heavy Rain. But I really admire this idea of a story that moves on no matter what you do.
I do too. I didn't dislike Heavy Rain as much as some people did. I liked Heavy Rain more than Fahrenheit. I thought that Heavy Rain definitely had its flaws, and looking back on it in hindsight, I probably would not enjoy it as much now as I did in the initial playthrough. But
no, it's kind of weird. You know, the more I play it, the more I dislike it. The more I think about it, the more I dislike it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, David Cage. But
That tends to happen with all of David Cage's games, though.
Yeah, but I still love Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
No, and Omicron, so it's really only one game. So.
I mean, because really it's... You go through it and you get the experience and you kind of, you know, turn your brain off and you're just kind of enjoying it for the entertainment. But then when you go back and you start analyzing all the plot holes and everything, then you're like, oh, really?
Plot holes?
Plot canyons. All right, yeah. Sorry.
There's more hole than there is plot in a David Cage game.
Well, and yet I'm still looking forward to playing Beyond Two Souls.
How weird is that?
What does that tell you?
How weird is it that you can still want to play something like that?
I know. I guess probably because of Ellen Page and Willem Dafoe.
No idea.
Well, yeah, of course you wouldn't have any idea.
Although apparently...
Okay, I'll tell you this. They're actually good actors as opposed to the ones in Heavy Rain. They've been in movies and they actually act well. Of course, that remains to be seen, you know, the kind of dialogue that they're going to have to say, David Cage dialogue. I've always said that I think one of the main problems with David Cage games is that he, being a non-native English speaker, writes Americans, and non-English speaking voice actors play Americans, and that just sounds off.
And you're an American, so you probably notice it even more than I do.
Yeah. So when you have your main character saying anything instead of anything, that kind of is a big tip-off. And when you've got French kids... Yeah, when you've got little French... Well, they were English. But when you've got the little French kids saying stuff like, "A little rain won't hurt no one!" It kind of takes you out of it.
Oh, man, that was... Was that a clip from the game? That was perfect.
Oh, thank you.
So, Heavy Rain, like I said, as much as the game itself annoys me, and I think there's... Some of the dramatization is pretty stupid, some of the plot's pretty stupid, I really admire the idea that you could have a game, you know, and you can mess up somewhere along the way, and instead of going game over, you know, restart or load from your last save, that goes, righto, that's what happened, keep playing, on with the show. And that, you know, and I'd really start to admire Heavy Rain more if one of the things you could have done during the game actually made the plot make sense at some point, I would have gone, oh, that's pretty good. But anyway, moving on from my continual bagging of David Cage. I'm sorry, David Cage.
Oh, he worked with to our podcast.
He made Omicron, so he's still cool.
Yeah, okay.
He's just slipped since then.
Well, actually, as long as we're talking about console games, let me bring up one that we both are very fond of, and I'm sure we'll enjoy talking about.
Everybody would know what you're going to say.
Yeah, what am I going to say?
It's Dishonored, isn't it?
Yes, it totally is.
How obvious is that? Let's talk about Dishonored. Because Dishonored implements consequence in a really, really nice way, really elegant.
In a really subtle way. And that I really appreciated it. The first time I played through Dishonored, and my voice just cracked there because I got excited about it. The first time
you're an excited
I played through,
teenager.
I am an excited teenager. So the first time I played through Dishonored, I tried to be stealthy, but I was excited, and I may have slipped and accidentally stabbed a few guards here and there. Mm. And Dishonored has the chaos system, which, in addition to affecting the ending, affects the game itself. Because there's a bit towards the end of Dishonored where you're going through the sewers and you get to a section and it's full of weepers, which are like the zombies of the game.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, and it was really tricky for me to get through that section, and I was like, man, I'm overwhelmed, there's so many people, and I had to sneak around and fight them all and stuff. And it was because the game tells you the more chaos you create, the more weepers and the more rats and things are going to be around. When I did my second playthrough, I was very careful, I was very stealthy, and when I got to that section, I thought, oh, here we go, I was going to brace myself for fighting all these weepers again, and you know what I found? I found a bunch of normal, healthy people who I could talk to, and I thought, wow, this is really cool! This section that I had so much trouble with, because I was nice, it's rewarding me by not having to deal with all of this stuff.
I think the best thing about Dishonored's chaos system is it really doesn't feel like an arbitrary system of rewarding the player. It really makes sense that if you go around in a plague-infested city killing lots of people, then the plague is going to bloom. The plague is going to get bigger, you know. It's a very elegant way of implementing consequence into a game without having it feel gamey. You know, because games often feel gamey, you know. Oh, you know, you did the right thing in this mission. You didn't alert anyone. Here, get the ghost trophy.
Yeah.
Big well, you know.
Well.
Big whoop.
It kind of is.
Yeah, but you... you know, but...
Anyway,
for someone that's not fixated on trophies...
Hush!
For someone like me, that's so much more rewarding to see a game... you know, implement consequence for your actions, you know. We're past the stage, I think, of high scores, you know. High scores became outdated the second that Another World or Out of This World was released and people realized you can tell an amazing story without needing a score, even in an arcade game. So, for me, Dishonored's system of implementing consequence is completely admirable, you know.
Yeah, then... you have, on the opposite side of the coin, where you have games like, for example, Infamous and Infamous 2.
Yeah. Where I've only played the first, but I enjoyed what I played.
It was done a bit more heavy-handed in the first one, because there were bits where, you know, you were faced with the choices.
Make
that
a choice!
Yeah, which would obviously affect whether you were good or famous or infamous, and he'd be like, oh, well, I guess I could... Well, it was more like, well, I guess I could take this food... and distribute it to the people, or I could be evil and eat it myself. And you know,
because gluttony is one of the seven sins.
Exactly, it's one of the cardinal sins. So yeah, and not only that, but you know, the more good or the more evil you did, the more it affected your avatar. You know, you'd turn blue or you'd turn red and dark and evil.
It is quite fun walking around the city and having people react to you.
Yeah, that was cool too, but it was a bit more obvious and gamey in that game.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of Fable, where you walk around and people go, you know, people immediately pick up, you know, you're the hero of the land.
At Fable, you know, you had, if you were good, you had a little halo, and if you were bad, you had little devil horns and flies flying around you, so it was pretty obvious from the get-go that you didn't, you know, people didn't need to pick up on things.
It's incredibly indicative of middle period Molyneux.
Oh, absolutely.
I like to split Molyneux into sort of periods. The early period, you know, with Populus and that sort of thing, when he was a real game changer. The middle period, when he was still kind of like doing, you know, black and white and Fable and experimenting with the idea of good and bad. And then there's the late period Molyneux where you click on squares.
Yeah. And when
and
you
cry in interviews.
And when you click on enough squares, you become the designer of his next game.
Ye 've I mentioned what I want Peter Molyneux's next project to be?
I don't think you have.
I want Peter Molyneux, like, the winner of the next Cube or Curiosity or whatever it's going to be. I want it to be a sort of get a remote control where you can remote control Peter Molyneux and be the designer of his life. The ultimate god sim. That's my idea, you know. And you can cry in interviews about that. I'm sorry, Peter Molyneux. I really respect what he did in his early years.
Oh, he doesn't listen to this podcast.
What?
But anyway, but
what?
Yes. Yeah, he doesn't. I hate to break it to you, but he doesn't listen to this podcast. Anyway.
But yeah, anyway, so that's a really obvious, and it's almost arbitrary, because who cares, you know?
Yeah, the thing that I remember about Fable, and I don't remember if it was Fable 1 or Fable 2 or one of those early Fables, was that he was talking about how the consequences were going to be so amazing that you could plant an acorn, and then years later you'd go to the same spot and there'd be an oak tree. And that's cool in concept, but really, what function does that serve in-game aside from just sort of a gee whiz factor?
Absolutely. It's not tied to the core mechanics and thus the core experience of the game. It's something completely arbitrary. And, yeah. You know... And I
although...
Don't arbitrary... Sorry.
Although, now that we say that, if there had been a path in Fable where you could be an oak farmer, then it's understandable.
I think the experience would have been improved by this.
Hmm.
I like arbitrary things in games. I gotta admit, like, there's one bit in Jagged Alliance 2... I don't know if you've ever played it, but it's basically an XCOM-style tactical strategy game where you move your mercs around, and you can hire mercs, and you can go on the internet, and you can hire mercs, and you can buy guns, and you can, you know, read emails and stuff like that. And one of the things you can do is you can send flowers, and you can send flowers to the evil queen that you're trying to chase down who hates you. And as a kid, man, I loved that. That was, like, the best thing in the entire world for me, was sending it. And you get to see her reaction, you know. And Jagged
Alliance... What is her reaction?
Oh, she slaps the hell out of her assistant, who she always slaps. And you go, oh, there we go. There's Deidreanna's normal reaction. Yeah, it really fits the game really well, you know, because you're tracking this queen down, and you see her every now and then as you make progress. It's a very open-ended game, but as you make progress, you can see her getting frustrated and vexed by your, you know, encroaching on her territory. And Jagged Alliance 2 really has a great way of dealing with consequence, you know, because it's very, very light. It's not heavy consequence where you've got devil wings and that, or angel things, you know. If your sort of mercenaries die while they're on mission, you know, their friends will become demotivated, and you know they won't, you know, they'll make comments. It's a lot like games like Baldur's Gate and stuff where they're sort of, they become depressed and they express concern and they don't perform quite as well. But there's also a funny little thing they implemented where if you save a lot, the game gradually gets harder with each save you do. So if you abuse quick saving, like heaps of people do, the game actually punishes you for it, which is a strange little consequence. But anyway, I mentioned people getting, you know, in Baldur's Gate, if you do the wrong thing, if you're a good character and you've got a party full of evil characters and you go around doing good things, then they, you know, they'll eventually leave your party and they express concern and argue with you and stuff like that, which I think is really nice. But in Dragon Age Origins, which was being hailed when it was first released as a spiritual successor to Baldur's Gate, when I played that, I got really annoyed, and everybody gets really annoyed at this, is there's two characters, two companions you get with you near the start of the game, and one of them is, you know, the typical, I'm a good boy, I'll never do anything wrong, and the other's like, oh, I'm the evil woman, I'll never do anything right. And no matter what choice you make, one of them will always comment, and it's this constant barrage of, oh, why are we doing this? Oh, I don't agree with this. It's like having two complaining kids along with you.
Ugh.
It's just the most painful thing. And I actually couldn't continue with the game because I was just that annoyed at everything I did. You know, and it was the stupidest, like, the tiniest little stuff, you know. A bear comes up asking for money and you have to make a choice. And no matter what choice you make, someone's going to comment on it. That sort of consequence in game is too, it's too much, you know. It just got to me. I was just like, oh, man. It's like the, it's like if you don't, if you don't hang out with your cousin in Grand Theft Auto 4 and he calls you constantly going, oh, cousin, we never go out. And you're just like, oh, man. And this is another thing I want to talk about is Grand Theft Auto 4, because there are some missions in the game where, you know, you have to run through this whole thing, this whole sort of building of enemies, shooting the hell out of all these enemies, you know. And then you get to the guy that's the objective and the game lets you decide whether you kill him or not.
Yeah.
What the hell? Why did I just, why the hell did I just run through a building mindlessly slaughtering hundreds of people, then suddenly switch character into, huh, should I kill him or not?
Well, because it's a Grand Theft Auto game.
It's ridiculous. I've mentioned this to you before. Unlike Vice City, where you play as a psychopath, and the guy admits to being a psychopath, and he acts like a psychopath. He doesn't, you know, the game doesn't weigh itself down with the idea of morality, because it doesn't fit. For me, it did not fit Grand Theft Auto. You know, one minute I'm running mindlessly over, you know, I'm squishing everyone mindlessly in my car, I'm blowing the hell out of buildings, the next minute I'm trying to decide if I let a guy live or not. With the knowledge that no matter what I do, it's going to affect my game later on.
I mean,
I didn't like that at all. That
don't get me wrong. I really liked Grand Theft Auto 4, but I agree with you. I think that the mistake that Rockstar made, as far as, I mean, I respect what they did trying to ground Grand Theft Auto 4 more in realism, but I think the reason that Vice City is so many people's favorite is, like you said, that aspect. Tommy is most people's favorite character because, like you said, he's an unrepentant psychopath. It's in his character. It's in his character for him to... Okay, Grand Theft Auto 3, the guy didn't talk, so he was basically a blank slate. He could be... You could play him how you wanted, but he was boring because he didn't talk.
He was. And the setting was boring.
And the setting... Yeah, the setting was pretty boring. It was just generic city. Vice City, okay, you had Vice City, which was Miami in the 80s with the great soundtrack. You had Tommy Vercetti, who was the self-admitted psychopath who didn't feel out of his character if you just decided to go on a rampage and start slicing people's heads off with a katana in the middle of the city. It felt like something he probably would do. He's the Harwood Butcher. Okay.
Exactly.
Whatever.
He's just got off a jail sentence.
Exactly. He has his little bit towards the end where he's talking to the printer guy and he's like, oh, well, you know, my dad was a printer and I would have had a different life. But it's not like... He doesn't say, oh, gee, I really wish I had a different life. He just kind of says it offhandedly like, yeah, I probably would have had a different life. But it's not like, oh, well, I don't like what I'm doing. He likes what he's doing.
I think that's that bit where you talk about where he's talking to the old printer is probably my favorite character interaction in any of the Grand Theft Auto games is between those two because it's so light. It's nothing, you know, but it's really meaningful because of it.
Yeah. Then in Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, I think that's when Rockstar started to think, okay, well, we have... protagonists who speak, let's give him a little bit more character. And then you had CJ, who... CJ was kind of a weird mix of the two, because you could have him... You could choose to make him really fat, you could choose to have him be really buff or skinny or whatever, you could choose his body type, you could choose his clothes, you could customize him out the window. And yet... It never felt right to have him go on a rampage because he had some semblance of morality to him. Yeah. He wasn't a psychopath. He liked his family. He had morals. And so it just felt strange to do that.
I agree.
Grand Theft Auto 4 even more because Nico is escaping his war country to start a new life and then he's like, "Oh, I am so tired of war and so many terrible things have happened because I am Nico Bellic." And then he can go and shoot up everybody in Liberty City.
The first thing you do.
Yeah, exactly. And he's like, "Oh, I thought this was all in my past. I guess not." And he's apparently Dracula too.
But an improvement, I think.
Yeah. See, I liked Grand Theft Auto 4. I really liked that iteration of Liberty City because it was New York and it was fun to drive around in. I really liked the graphics. I liked to an extent the story. I liked Nico as a character, but I felt guilty going all out and killing people because I felt that wasn't in Nico's character. And that's really, for me, it wasn't a big deal because I really, the thing about that I enjoy about Grand Theft Auto isn't just going around mindlessly killing people, but for people who do enjoy that, I think that that's kind of a betrayal to the player because it feels so out of character to do that for Nico that it just doesn't work, you know? And I'm hopeful for GTA 5 because it seems like they're kind of, in having the three protagonists, they're really going for that whole kind of, because Trevor seems like he's the complete psychopath. So if he goes around and just destroys everything, all right, that's cool. And then Michael's like, you know, the whatever, and Trevor or Franklin is the he's kind of the, I guess, the in between of the two. So we'll see what happens with that. But we're veering, I think we're veering a little off of the topic of consequence. Well, but the point is, Grand Theft Auto 4, again, it did do that. And Grand Theft Auto 4 had two pretty different endings based on, you didn't finish the game.
But, I didn't, I couldn't.
Yeah, you couldn't finish
it. I couldn't bring myself to finish it with all of the phone calls. And,
but, basically you have two endings. You have a, I mean, they're both kind of bummers, but one's kind of less of a bummer than the other one.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, it wasn't, Rockstar really honed their storytelling thing with Red Dead Redemption, definitely.
They really did.
But that's the problem with the Grand Theft Auto game. In having an open world game like that, where you can't, I don't think it's really easy to do a character like that, or that they want to have to give morals to, because there's the fact that you can go out and kill everybody. I mean, even John Marston, if he went on a rampage and killed people, maybe a little out of character, but still kind of in character, because we know that he's an outlaw.
He's had a violent past. He'll do anything to protect his family, and he's surrounded by assholes.
Exactly. So, yeah.
I don't think John Marston going on a rampage was really out of character. It was him doing whatever he had to do to get rid of his past. For me, anyway. But
plus, it actually had a sort of a little meter of positive and negative theme.
I think the biggest problem with morality, and we kind of, and consequence, and we kind of got away from this a little bit, but is how black and white it can sometimes seem be portrayed, you know? I really feel like a lot of games when I'm playing it, I'm either playing the good ending or I'm playing the bad ending. In Dishonored, I think I killed two people, you know? So I didn't play a perfect good playthrough, but I still got the happy ending, you know? I still got the low curse ending. There were a couple of times where I strayed, but I don't feel like because you stray once, you should be punished for the whole game, you know? And I really like the idea of black and white, not black and white morality, shades of grey. This is really promoted by CD Projekt guys when they made the Witcher games. You haven't played The Witcher or The Witcher 2, but
I have not, no.
They really embraced the idea of there's no such thing really as good or bad in the Witcher games, you know? You get, there'll be cases where you've got to make a decision between a bad thing and a bad thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that, you know? Someone's going to get hurt, you just decide who. And I think, and even at one point in the original Witcher, I got what we call paralyzed by choice, where you've got to make a game-altering choice, and it's really hard to make. You know, there's a point in The Witcher 2 as well where it becomes really clear where your playthrough is going to take either one of two paths. But the best, like I said, the best thing about The Witcher, and I think more games ought to embrace this if they're going to implement consequence into their games, is rather than going, here's the good path, here's the bad path, make your choice. Like, you know, a lot of Star Wars games, they go, turn to the dark side or, you know, stay with the, which is ridiculous, you know? People are shades of grey. So it really pleases me to see a game like The Witcher embracing this idea of a character not being this yes or no Boolean variable. They're this sort of, they're corruptible if they're good, or they're redeemable if they're bad, you know.
Right.
And that, I like Consequence that deals with that. I like games where, you know, if you play Planescape Torment, basically, that's all I can say. That's all I can add to this. I say this every podcast, Planescape Torment. It really is a phenomenal game. But yeah,
that
I like
the Planescape Torment podcast.
Yeah, the idea is good. The idea is sound. I like that. And I love the fact that the people that worked on Planescape Torment are making more games. Like Project Eternity and Torment, Shades of Nomananarara. I don't even know how to pronounce it.
Okay, let's turn down the fanboys of it. I think we should probably reel this discussion in. But as a final point, I think we should talk about adventure games and the consequence as far as replayability of adventure games. Because if you have an adventure game, like, for example, The Walking Dead, where the story, like I said, is mostly the same, but the paths to get there are different. There's replayability because you want to go back and you want to see what, you know, the slight little differences, what happens if you do things differently, even though you might end up at the same end result. Versus a game like, for example, a very linear game with no branching paths, like, for example, King's Quest or a Space Quest or even Full Throttle or Monkey Island, where you play through the game, you play the story, and there's really no incentive to go back and play it again. Unless you're like me, who's a nerd who likes to go and replay the old classics every now and then for nostalgia.
Well, sure. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure we all do it, but if you boil it down, there's really no reason once you play a game and you know the story to go back and play it again. Which is why...
Once you figured the puzzles out, yeah.
Right, once you figured out the puzzles and you know the ending, you can think, oh, okay, that was a nice story, but you don't really need to go back and play it again. Whereas you could play The Walking Dead again, and maybe even two or three more times, and have different choices and different paths, and see different parts that you didn't necessarily see before.
Sure.
So
I think it's a little bit like Resonance, where there's all these optional things, you know, and there's exploration to be had, even if you finish the game.
Right. And that's what I like, too, about the Wajedi games, or just any games that have commentary, the little extra features and stuff, because you can go back and play the game for that, even if the game doesn't necessarily have multiple endings. But it's a bonus if they do have multiple endings, too.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. As somebody that has used score in adventure games, how do you feel about the idea? I know I just recently, in this podcast, bagged the idea of a score in a game, but how do you feel about score in adventure games?
Well, the whole reason that I was doing score in the Ben Jordan games was because they were such a throwback to the old Sierra classics that I grew up with. That was kind of a thing that you kind of expected in them.
Sure.
If I feel that if you're going to have a score, it kind of serves two purposes. One is to kind of be a progress meter to kind of give you an indication of how far in the game you are.
Yep.
But also, if you finish a game and you don't have a full score, I think that if you're going to have a score, you should reward the player for having a full score, whether it be a different ending or just like a little extra something or I don't know, something. Because
like in Ben Jordan 5.
Yeah, well, that was if you got a full score and you did a certain thing. But if you got a full score, you got a little teaser as to what the title of the next case was going to be.
Sure.
So, because otherwise it really doesn't make a difference, because, you know, you could not get a full score, and big deal if there's no difference if you got
who
the full
cares?
Score.
Yeah.
Who cares? Exactly.
I think I often treat scores in old adventure games or new adventure games. I haven't played a new adventure game with the score since I last played Ben Jordan 8, I think.
Yeah.
But I think I often treat them like I treat achievements. You know, getting a full score is like getting an achievement. If you're a completionist, then getting the full score, you go, yeah, I got a full score. I finished the game with a full score. I'll take a screenshot. Everybody, look at my score. I'm amazing.
Right, exactly.
You know, whereas someone like me, that I don't really care about trophies. I don't really care about full scores, you know. I care about exploring the game for the sake of exploring a game. For me, a trophy or a score, big deal, you know.
Yeah. And I've since done away with the score mechanic. I really think it's pretty useless. It's just as useless as having, you know, a hand and a talk icon. So
I guess what I'd say is I prefer it when a game implements rewards such as, you know, whatever. If you do that little extra stuff, I'd prefer if a game implemented it more sort of integral to the game itself rather than some extra thing like a score or a trophy. I'd rather it be recognized in the game as some form of consequence there. Whether it's a little animation or it's, you know, a little bit of extra dialogue or something like that, for me, that's much more appealing than the notion of, oh, you know, you got all of the points. Big deal. For me, when I was making Piss, I'll go back to it because it's really the only game I've done where there's much consequence. I wanted to implement gameplay that wasn't so linear and, you know, it was variable. And I thought, well, I could just have the player get points, and once they've got a certain amount of points, you know, get the thing. I thought, oh, well, I'll make them earn money. You know, that worked for me. So I came up with the idea of, you know, instead of doing a normal adventure game thing where you're constantly solving puzzles, just making you do whatever you need to do to earn money. And you can earn about twice as much money as you need to get past the first part of the game. So I really made it a lot more work for myself. But for me, that's a lot more, you know. Even if it's like in a first-person shooter game, having a secret area with a new weapon, or, you know, consequence can be so much more than, oh, different endings. You know, if you play Grand Theft Auto 2, depending on what faction you help is where you can roam freely in the city. And I think that's a pretty weak example of consequence, but it does show that there's more than just, oh, you got a different ending in the game, you know. Right. So, yeah. There's probably a lot of games that I should play that I haven't yet played that talk about consequence, like Facade. I've never played Facade. I really should.
Oh, man, Facade.
Have you played Facade?
I have played Facade, yes.
How do you feel about Facade?
Well, I haven't played it in a really long time, and it's not really a game per se. It's really just more of a little experimental consequence simulator, I guess. Yeah, it's a toy, basically.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, it has its flaws, but it's pretty fun for a little while. Okay. It's one of those games that kind of gives you more the illusion of having an impact on the story than actually having one, but it's interesting. It's an interesting little play, as it's meant to be.
I should make sure I try it out.
Yeah, you should. It takes like 10 minutes at most to play.
Okay.
But yeah. Anyway, I think that as a consequence of talking so much, we probably should end this podcast.
Which ending are we going to get?
Well, if
do
you
I get
press...
to choose?
Yeah.
Do I get to choose?
Yes, you can choose. See, you can either have the ending where we end the podcast by saying goodbye. You can choose the ending where we end the podcast on an awkward pause. Or you can choose the ending where we do a big musical number and have some explosions.
Is that all the choices I get?
Well, there's three. How many more do you want?
I want more. This isn't enough. I don't know which one. This is really hard. Man, I'm paralyzed by all this difficult choice. Which one do I want to play?
You've only got 15 seconds to decide.
I think I'll go with option B. Awkward pause it is.
Okay. Well, Chandler,
Yeah.